Hello listeners and welcome to Sportspiel episode 6. The United Kingdom has recently basked in a heatwave. People have been melting and getting sunburnt up and down the land, and yet, still, the temperatures were no match for the fiery readings that make up Sebastian Vettel's temper. In much the same way that Lewis Hamilton was jolted by the hot-headed German, we, the British public, have also been jolted back into the reality of a UK summertime as the rain begins to pour. Or are those the tears of the England under 21 side? Joining me as ever to discuss all things sport is Mr. Will Moulton.
Wow, just wow. I mean, are you sure you haven't studied English literature or something? Because it's very, very, very moving what you come
in a,
out
in a parallel universe, intros. That is probably my career path.
It's good to be back. I'm regretting wearing shorts in this weather. It is a bit chilly.
British summertime has well and truly started.
At least it's not raining at the moment, though, he says.
Give it an hour. In our first segment today, our sports discussion section, we're going to go through some of the stories that have caught our eye in the last couple of weeks. First up, we're going to talk about the rather eventful Azerbaijan Grand Prix. You may have seen the two title challenges coming together quite literally in that race. Next up, we're going to talk about the world of tennis. There's plenty, quite a few stories going on at the moment. Dan Evans, British number 3, has tested positive for cocaine. John McEnroe has compared Serena Williams to the world number 700 in the men's tour. And also Petra Kvitova is on the comeback. After that, it's the England under 21. Surprise, surprise, they went out of the under 21 European Championships on penalties to Germany. After that, it's the British and Irish Lions. They had their first test against the All Blacks. It didn't go swimmingly. And finally, something I will not often say on this podcast, we're going to talk about the one, the only, the orange man himself, Donald Trump. In our second segment today, our feature interview section, Will spoke to Paralympic wheelchair racer Sammy Kinghorn about her career, racing for glory, and also the serious accident that saw her paralysed from the waist down. All that and more on Sportspiel. Well, we're going to race into, pun intended, the first topic of discussion today, which is the Azerbaijan Grand Prix. Formula One went to Baku last weekend, and it was quite a topsy-turvy race, to say the least. In the end, it was Red Bull's Daniel Ricciardo that finished first after he found himself at 17th at one point, and Mercedes' Valtteri Bottas grabbed second on the line, just beating 18-year-old Lance Stroll from Williams. But the main talking point throughout the race, other than people crashing into each other, is the two championship contenders quite literally coming together. Now, Sebastian Vettel was driving behind Lewis Hamilton. They were all going behind the safety car at the moment, and Vettel went into the back of Lewis Hamilton's car. Sebastian Vettel said that he was brake checked by the Brit, and he then went to drive alongside and walloped him from the left. Something that caught, I think, Lewis Hamilton a bit by surprise after. Sebastian Vettel did get punished for that during the race. He received a 10-second stop-go penalty. But Lewis Hamilton's headrest came loose during the race, meaning that in the end he finished fifth behind Sebastian Vettel, who came fourth. Now, Lewis Hamilton said over the radio that the 10-second stop-go penalty wasn't enough for what Sebastian Vettel did. Do we agree?
I don't think he'd be saying that if he hadn't had the headrest issue. We're just thinking back to a similar incident. So we go back to Monaco 2012 when Pastor Maldonado in free practice deliberately swerved into Sergio Perez. That was in practice session, so he was given a 10-place grip penalty, and I think that is a much harsher punishment than a 10-second stop-go penalty. But the rules stipulate that the standard punishment for dangerous driving is a 10-second stop-and-go penalty. So from that point of view, the punishment was just. However, I wouldn't be surprised if he was then given another, maybe a 5-place grip penalty for the next race, because it wasn't just dangerous driving, it was ridiculous. It's hard to tell from the camera angle whether he's done it deliberately or not, because you see one hand is off the wheel. Has he lost control of the car? But the car does suddenly violently swerve to the right, and the steering wheels in Formula One cars don't just go like that. So I wouldn't be surprised if he gets another penalty. Whether he should or not, I'm not entirely sure. I think he might have served, as much as I don't like Vettel that much, I think he's probably served his penalty. And if Hamilton hadn't been unlucky with the headrest, I don't think he'd be saying that necessarily.
Exactly, because in the end it wasn't that that caused Hamilton's race to be spoiled. It was someone not clipping the headrest back on properly after the race was stopped. But Vettel is starting to become a rather unlikable character in the sport. His temper seems to be ramping up as he gets older, and Lewis Hamilton said himself that his actions set a bad example to young up-and-coming drivers, which I think is true.
I don't think necessarily he's becoming an unlikable driver. I think a lot of people have found him unlikable from not when he was first at Toro Rosso or Sauber, because he was fine then, but sort of 2009, 2010, he became very, very impetuous, and the way he was treated at Red Bull was like the sun shone out of his bottom. Whereas Mark Webber, and those Mark Webber fans like myself, he got the rough end of the deal all the time. And then we saw, he sort of calmed down a little bit when he first went to Ferrari, especially in 2015. But then we saw at the Mexican Grand Prix last year, there was a lot of swearing.
He does across
the season, there was a lot of swearing, calling Daniel Kvyat all names under the sun when they crashed a couple of times early in the season. But then he even directed his anger at Charlie Whiting and called him an effing something or other, which is just, that's not on. I think he's got himself just a little bit too inflated, maybe his ego, and I think he just needs bringing down that level, because there are drivers out there just as good as him, and he isn't the one everyone wants to see in the sport, to be honest. Everyone wants to see Lewis Hamilton, don't they?
Exactly, particularly on these shores. And what do we think then? Because the title race has been fairly respectful up until now. Is it going to continue in much the same vein?
They've said previously, Vettel and Hamilton, that they've got a good relationship outside of this, and I don't think this incident is going to change it that much. I don't think it'll be the same as it was before, but they're on different sides. It's not going to be like Hamilton and Rosberg were, I don't think. And I hope it's not, because that got a bit pathetic and it was a bit manufactured in the end. If I want to see them racing hard, I want to see aggressive racing, I want to see them pushing each other. And if it gets a bit spicy, it gets a bit spicy, but I don't want it to be manufactured by the media and by the teams to make it this big rivalry when it isn't.
Exactly, and we always like a little bit of natural spice here and there. But away from probably the most exciting race of the season so far, and we're going to go into tennis. There's been a lot of tennis news just over the last week. Now, the first thing that we're going to talk about is British number 3 Dan Evans. Earlier this week, he announced that he failed a drugs test. He had tested positive for cocaine. Kyle Edmund, the British number 2, said that he was lost for words over the announcement, and Jamie Murray said that his actions had put his career in jeopardy. Since then, Evans has lost his sponsor, Elise. We think that's how it says.
LSA.
We're going to quibble over that pronunciation, but it's effectively his kit manufacturer. And he could face a maximum 4-year ban. He admits that he made a mistake and that he must own up to it, but he really is a wasted talent, isn't he?
In fact, there's a stronger saying than that. I found an article from, I think it was The Telegraph, back in early 2016, which described him as the most egregious, are we pronouncing that word again?
Egregious
wasted talent in British tennis. And that was in 2016, when he was still 500 or something in the world. He then, after that, enjoyed quite a meteoric rise, getting into the top 50, played some good tennis, got through to the third round of Wimbledon and the US Open, the fourth round of the Australian Open this year. And yet he was still quite a hard player to like, I felt. I don't know about how you felt.
No, it was always the same, because he's always had this rep as a little bit of a party boy, drinking too much. I mean, we mentioned before that he went out drinking mere hours before he was due on court.
Yeah, that was back in 2008 when he was 18, when it was the first time he had his funding stripped. He had a doubles match to a junior Wimbledon back in 2008, and just hours before he went out clubbing. He then was stripped of his funding again in 2012 as the coaches said they found his lack of commitment frustrating, and he wasn't taking training seriously, and he was turning up drunk and hungover. But interestingly enough, earlier this year, back in January, he claimed that his love of a night out and drink was controlled. And while that might have been controlled,
drug taking, however.
Drug taking. It's just, oh.
Yes.
He's enjoyable as a player to watch. He's frustrating because he still makes a lot of mistakes. But he's a good tennis player to watch, but I've just never found him as a person that easy to like.
Exactly. Just when you know that you've been blessed with such talent at that sport, why not commit yourself fully to actually reach the best of your abilities? And his off-court behaviour through the years hasn't really put him in the best place to fulfil his potential.
Definitely, and now he's faced with this potentially 4-year ban,
which would make him 31 by the time he comes back, and that's effectively career done.
So you definitely think that's the end of his career then?
Absolutely.
Yeah,
yes.
I can't see anyone wanting to fund him or sponsor him after this, even if it's only a 1-year ban. So,
but not with his background.
No, I mean, there is potential of a way back. Sharapova's coming back from her own drugs ban, slightly different, and she had that gleaming golden girl reputation before, which has sort of eased her back into the sport.
It does help that she's a highly marketable person.
Yeah,
whereas I don't think Dan Evans really is.
No, he hasn't. Apart from a Davis Cup win, he hasn't got that much to shout about.
Exactly. But from one bad boy of tennis to perhaps the ultimate bad boy of tennis in John McEnroe, the 7-time Grand Slam winner. Now, you may have seen this in the news. He said that 23 Grand Slam title winner Serena Williams, one of the best players in the world, would be ranked around 700 in the men's game. He qualified the comments by saying, "That doesn't mean I don't think Serena is an incredible player. And I suppose anything is possible. Maybe at some point a women's tennis player can be better than anybody. I just haven't seen that in any other sport. And I haven't seen it in tennis. If she had just to play the men's circuit, it would be an entirely different story." Unsurprisingly, Serena herself came back in response to John McEnroe on Twitter, saying this: "Dear John, I adore and respect you, but please, please keep me out of your statements that are not factually based. I've never played anyone ranked there, inverted commas, nor do I have time. Respect me and my privacy as I'm trying to have a baby. Good day, sir."
That's the ultimate response, isn't it?
Pretty much. But for me, it summed up this perennial battle of the sexes debate that we seem to keep harking back to. First question I have is, why do we keep having to justify Serena's achievements in relation to the men?
I don't know. She's the greatest female tennis player there's ever been. That should be enough.
It should be enough, shouldn't it?
It should be enough, shouldn't it? She's outrageously talented.
I know people keep trying to want to compare this, that and the other, but can't we just appreciate her achievements in the sport and the likes of Djokovic and Federer and Nadal in the men's side of the sport and appreciate them for great athletes and what they've done?
Exactly. We don't say, oh, Jess Ennis-Hill isn't a fantastic and amazing athlete because she hasn't competed in the men's decathlon, do we? So
exactly.
why Serena Williams has won 23 Grand Slams against some fantastic opposition in the women's game. I mean, at the moment, yeah, it's a little bit open without her there, and there is maybe not the standard that there has been at other times, but she's had to overcome some fantastic players, including her sister over the years, players like Lee Na as well, and Victoria Azarenka in her prime was a fantastic player. Maria Sharapova, another fantastic player. She's beaten all of them. Justin Henin Arden, another one. I've probably missed a couple out that
there's
probably
should 23 titles,
there.
There's a lot, but that she's beaten.
I don't see why we need to compare her to a male tennis player, because it is a different game. And Serena herself, a few years back, came out and said if she played Andy Murray, she would lose 6-love in 5 to 10 minutes, because the men's game is a different game, and she's not suited for the men's
exactly.
game. She's suited for her game. She plays her game, and she wins her game. That should be all that matters. But Dmitry Tursunov, former world number 20, who's now ranked 701st in the world, hasn't exactly helped with some of his comments, has he? He's come out and said he hopes he would beat Serena Williams, but his main reasoning for that was, she's pregnant and I'm not. Which is sort of countering his own argument there by saying, so if she wasn't pregnant, then you wouldn't beat her, or?
Well, yeah, I mean, most people probably stand a better chance against Serena, considering she is heavily pregnant at the moment and probably isn't as fleet-footed as she usually is.
But yeah, and I also saw a comment from Tursunov earlier. There was a Twitter question from someone asking, having a go at him, almost saying, well, if when it was unequal, why didn't you have women playing on the men's tour then? If for whatever reason. I don't quite understand the context. It was in slightly broken English. But then Tursov just turned around and said, it would be like taking kids' lunch money. Does that imply that he thinks that they would just be getting a bump in every week? Not the greatest thing to say, I don't think, from Tursov.
Not really.
Especially in English, which isn't his first language.
Oh, definitely not. And we've seen a number of cases, particularly this week, of foreign players having their opinions sort of lost in translation. Mm. So the passing judgment. We'll give him the benefit of the doubt on this occasion, maybe.
But what do you think of McEnroe's proposal of that he came up with today of a men's versus women's game to prove his point?
See, it would definitely be an interesting spectacle. And I believe Billie Jean King played against a man at some point.
She did at some point.
That's
in
my
her career.
Vague knowledge of tennis history
should have done our research.
It'd definitely be an interesting spectacle, but I don't think we really need an answer, because I don't think it's a question that really needs to be asked.
No. It's two different sports, really.
Just appreciate them for what they are,
yeah,
in my view.
And the women's game is quite often more interesting than the men's.
Particularly when Serena's not out of it, it's quite open.
Yeah, exactly.
We've just seen non-seeded player win the French Open.
Yeah,
That was very talented as well.
Yeah, she looks a good player.
I wish I could remember her name now.
Ostapenko.
Thank you.
The Latvian. But yeah, there's a number of good women around as well. Garbi Muguruza, she's a very, very good player, especially on clay. Angelique Kerber, Radvanska, you've got the Pliskovas.
And tying quite neatly into final tennis topic, the feel-good story of this is Petra Kvitova.
Another top player as well.
Another top player, two-time Wimbledon champion. And she has just clinched the Aegon Classic title in Birmingham. Now, it's her first title since she was stabbed in the hand by an intruder at her home in the Czech Republic. It's really quite a comeback in what is her second tournament since she returned.
I think Kvitova's always been a likable player. She's
definitely
always certainly been a fan favourite at Wimbledon, having won there twice. She's just she just seems a lovely person. She's got a great smile on her face, and she's a fantastic tennis player as well. So when we all saw this that she'd sustained this horrendous injury, thinking, oh, she might lose a left hand as well, thinking, oh, we won't be seeing her for a while yet. But yeah, 6 months later, she's
six
back.
Months,
she's winning tournaments. She's going to be playing at Wimbledon. I think it's fantastic, and yeah, I just can't. I'd love to see her win Wimbledon.
The crowd would certainly roar onto that victory, because what a story that would be if she manages to win Wimbledon after that.
But what if she was playing someone like Heather Watson or Laura Robson or Joanna Konta in the final?
Then maybe on this occasion, but she would definitely have a large section of the support cheering her on.
Yeah, and let's hope she continues to play, doesn't have any more repercussions, and gets back to the top of her game, because again, she's one of the best players, female players around. And
exactly. But a different side of the spectrum, I think, in terms of determination with Kvitova and Dan Evans.
Yeah.
But on to the third topic today, and it's a headline that we've grown quite accustomed to seeing over the years. England have lost to Germany in a major football tournament on penalties. This time, it's the England under-21s. There are a few things certain in life, but one of them is going out to Germany on penalties.
Or Portugal,
or Italy, or anyone.
Yeah, the Dutch.
The game itself, it was the semi-final of the tournament after A.D. Boothroyd's men managed to get through the group stage. The game finished 2-2 after extra time, and then they lost 4-3 on the dreaded spot kicks. Southampton's Nathan Redmond was the man with the decisive miss. Penalties are always a problem for England, but that game to me showed a more crucial problem, I think, for the England setup, not just the under-21s, but all teams. In terms of tactics, why is it, whenever we take the lead, because they were 2-1 up, why is it then that we sit back and invite pressure?
Because we don't know, because we don't know how to win, or
it's time and time again, I've seen this.
I don't know, I think it's always quite conservative, we're always quite conservative, aren't we? We don't like to push on. Which is ridiculous. You might as well take a risk and gamble and try and get a third goal. I think fans would be happier if you conceded that equaliser, pushing for another goal rather than sitting back and hoping that they don't
score. And keeping your fingers crossed.
And that German side is a very good side, a very attacking side.
Rather tragically, not their strongest under-21 side as well, because a lot of the players eligible are currently at the Confederations Cup playing for the German senior team.
Exactly, but it's still a good side. And I think initially England did really well to come back from 1-0 down. I think when they went 1-0 down, having had a good start to the game, I think everyone thought, oh, here we go again. Came back to lead 2-1, push on from there, at least try and make it safe. Don't take it to penalties, because we all know what's going to happen.
Exactly. But time and time again, it seems that the pressure always seems to get the better of us in the end, whenever we're watching. And I always think that that's maybe part of English players' issues when they're trying to break their way into senior teams at both international and club level.
But also, I don't think a lot of these players haven't been in knockout tournaments, either for club or country, where they've been in the league, because so many of these players don't play regularly enough for their clubs. So they don't, say, play in the FA Cup semi-final where they're 2-1 up and then they need to hold on or try and get another goal. So I think it's just a case of just the lack of experience of how to deal with that situation, and then the tactical issue as well from the management.
Exactly. The tactical thing stands out for me because we see German teams, no matter the generation, constantly managing to pull it out of the bag when it comes to knockout tournament football. And I did a feature at the start of the week, before the semi-final, comparing the 2009 European Under-21 Championship final, which was, of course, was England and Germany as well, and comparing where those players are today.
Mm.
Germany had the likes of Mesut Özil, World Cup winner, Manuel Neuer, World Cup winner, Mats Hummels, World Cup winner. England had Adam Johnson, prison.
Yeah. We'll ignore him.
Yes, and a host of other players, Martin Craney being one, Scott Loach, all didn't make senior
Scott Loach
appearances.
Just signed for a new club this week, didn't he?
He did, National League side Hartlepool United.
Oh dear.
Some players did go on to have good careers, such as James Milner, Mark Noble, even though he never actually made a senior appearance, which I think is an injustice, but that's for another day, and I'm a biased West Ham fan. But again, that shows to me, why do the Germans keep getting it right and we keep getting it wrong?
I've genuinely got no idea.
It's the ultimate question.
Because we have the best league in the world, perhaps that's where we're going wrong, is that our league is too good and that it's attracting foreign players. I think the Chelsea story this week is a prime example. They had three fantastic centre-backs on show at the under-20s and the under-21 championships. Nathaniel Chalobah had a fantastic tournament with the under-21s. He could also be a central midfielder as well. And yet, they've also got Nathan Aki in the wings, and yet they're bringing in this Bakayoko, 23-year-old from Monaco, who's never played
midfielder,
for France.
Yeah.
He's 30 million, and he can also play centre-back. And what's the point? You've got some ready-made English players who can step up.
See, I always say that the problem in that situation is money. And Chelsea have stockpiled young talent in the hope for a profit. I raised the point about Brazilian wonder kid Kennedy. Remember him at Chelsea?
He played a game at the end of last season.
Exactly. He was bought from Fluminense. And he went on loan to Watford at the start of the season, played once. Was recalled in January and then played another 2 times under Antonio Conte. But as another young player lost to the system.
It's frustrating because there are some managers in the Premier League who do a really, really good job of bringing through the young talents. So we saw Pochettino, both at Southampton and Spurs, plays the young kids. Jurgen Klopp plays the young kids. Claude Puel, I mean, he's now been sacked from Southampton, but he played the kids as he needed to last season. But he brought through the English players, Sam McQueen, Jack Stevens, even James Ward-Prowse, and made them regulars, and they played really well. And it's frustrating that there are certain managers in the league, Conte, Mourinho, even perhaps Wenger to an instance. He has been good with bringing young players through, but not recently. They would rather rely on some foreign player who's got a price tag than young English talent, and it's frustrating.
Exactly. So we hope some of these players will push on. We're going to switch to the British and Irish Lions. Since we last spoke about them, they picked their squad when we last spoke about them, and here we are today, and they've just played their first test against the All Blacks on Saturday, which was a 30-15 defeat. The All Blacks were indeed very impressive and tough, and Warren Gatland's side certainly suffered a lesson. Good first try, the Lions scored, and they had their opportunities but didn't take them at all, and just got hit by a strong, resilient, absolutely incredible All Black side.
I think the way the tour had been going up to that point, I think a lot of people, including myself, were expecting a heavy loss for the Lions. So to come away with a 30-15 loss wasn't too bad. And to play some decent rugby in there as well and not look completely overawed by New Zealand, I think that was promising. However, I thought New Zealand were also in about second gear. I think they could have stepped up at any moment when they wanted to.
That's the worrying thing.
But, yeah, it was just frustrating because, especially in the start of that second half, England had the ball, England had territory, England had chances, didn't make the most of them. And two of the tries they conceded were just switching off at penalties. And then the scrum halves, Aaron Smith?
I have no idea.
Can't remember. And it was frustrating that two of the tries came from penalties where England had just switched off. They were taken quickly, ball went through the hands, they went over the line.
Exactly. But another talking point that came out this week is that Warren Gatland called up Finn Russell, Alan Dell, Christian Dacey, Thomas Francis, Corey Hill and Gareth Davis as injury cover because they were geographically closer. It came in for a fair amount of criticism, unsurprisingly, because people thought that he devalued the Lions jersey because the likes of Joe Launchbury away with England in Argentina weren't called up when they probably should have been because they were further away. And that controversy influenced Gatland's decision not to bring on a majority of his replacements during the 31-31 draw against the Hurricanes on Tuesday. So far, only Dell and Russell have featured for the Lions. And it means I'm asking the question, what was the point then in calling these players up if you're not going to actually play them?
The point was injury cover. But they were the wrong players to call up. And I think Gatland has now seen that he knows they were the wrong players to call up. In terms of, I think Alan Dell... No one had heard of Alan Dell. He's played 10 games for Scotland, I think, started at the end of last year. I had no idea who he was when he was called up. I had to Google him. The likes of Corey Hill and Christian Dacey, talented young Welsh players, and obviously Gatland has seen them, and he was the one who initially brought them into the Wales squad. But they've got 10 caps between the two of them. Like Christian Dacey's forever on the bench, behind Ken Owens and the likes. Corey Hill's played a few games, but at lock, he's got fantastic competition in Wales from the likes of Jake Ball and Alan Wynne-Jones. And if you're going to call up a lock, you've got to call up Launchbury, haven't you?
Surely. But the thing that stood out for me with Warren Gatland is that he picks these players as injury backup and then suddenly the controversy goes against him, so he changes his mind. And to me, that shows weakness. If you're going to pick these players, surely then you live by your decisions. You are fully committed to them. The fact that he suddenly reacted to this external backlash shows weakness for me, and he seems to be slightly losing his mind as this tour goes on.
I don't know, I think it depends on how you interpret it, because Gatland is very bloody minded and he's going to do it his way and that's it. And I don't necessarily think...
Except on this occasion.
But I think necessarily he might have seen them in training and think, actually, I've called up the wrong players here, but just won't admit it. I don't know if he's necessarily listens to criticism, because he's been criticised for playing Warren ball, especially, for so long, and he's never deviated from that. I don't see why he would listen to the negativity now. But I think he's definitely realised that these players aren't currently in the best form.
Certainly,
at least.
I think quite a few people maybe would have told him that beforehand.
Well, it's not just those players. There are three Welsh players. I don't want to pick on the Welsh because there are a lot of players out of form, but Dan Bigger, George North and Lee Halfpenny are on this tour. They're hopeless. All three of them are hopelessly out of form. They're nowhere near their best, and he's not picking them, and he's picking the players in form, but he's not picking Jack Noel, which I think a lot of people are criticising, because Jack Noel is on fire every time. I know he's not been great on this tour, but he started to come good now, and I think people want to see him play. Let's just see what happens in the next two tests.
Wait and see. See if it's a whitewash or not.
Anything could happen.
Anything.
England. The Lions could pull out a fantastic victory. They could be thrashed. No one really knows what's going to happen.
We hope
next.
That's not going to happen. But speaking of anything is possible. And in this regard, we're going to talk about a topic that wouldn't normally appear on a podcast like this, and that's Mr. Donald Trump, a man who neither of us are particularly fans of.
No.
Now, normally we wouldn't discuss politics or the most orange man in the world, but we're talking about the US president because of the National Basketball Association champions, the Golden State Warriors. As has sort of become the norm, when a team in the USA wins a big championship, they're invited to the White House. However, the Golden State Warriors have said they would turn down the offer if given to them. Star player Stephen Curry was quoted as saying, Somebody asked me about it a couple of months ago. A hypothetical, if a championship were to happen, what would I do? I answered I wouldn't go. I still feel that way today. On a similar sort of note, the head coach of the Golden State Warriors, Steve Kerr, also called Trump a blowhard. Perhaps not the best impression of the US president. However, on the other hand, the NHL Stanley Cup champions, Pittsburgh Penguins, who we mentioned last time, have said that they would accept an invite if they were to get one. And of course, the Super Bowl champions, the New England Patriots, did go to the White House after they won and they met Trump. But of course, their quarterback and star man, Tom Brady, is a well-known Trump fan. So that begs the question, what would you do? Would you go and see the floppy-haired president if you were invited?
Oh, that's a tough one, because I might never see the White House again otherwise. But you don't want to be seen to be in the company of a man who's so controversial and so wrong in a number of ways.
So wrong. I suppose one thing I should point out as well is that the NBA is primarily an African-American league. It's got a lot of African-American players in it. On the other side, the NHL has a lot of Canadian players in it who don't really, you know, have a vesting interest in who's governing the US at the moment. But the way I always thought about it is that if you get an invite, it's an invite to the office of the presidency rather than the incumbent president.
Yeah, I think if it's not politically motivated, if it's just a visit because you've won, then I don't see why you shouldn't go.
There's been 44 other guys before him.
Yeah, I don't see, and there's been some people just as bad as him. So I don't know. I think if I was sure there was sort of no political agenda to it or anything, then I think I probably would go just for the experience, because you might never get to do it again.
Yeah, I suppose it's easy for us to say because we're never going to be in that position. But if we were invited, we'd probably be keen to go. Mm. But it does show you how politicised sport, particularly in America, at the moment is. And we see Colin Kaepernick, for example, in the NFL refusing to stand for the national anthem over, you know, protesting about the treatment of African Americans in the country. It's becoming a very highly politicised environment at the moment, and it just fuels it further.
Well, we'd love to know what you think as well. So that's going to be this week's poll. So if you had won the NBA, would you want to go and visit Donald Trump? Yes, no, or what was the other option you thought of?
My third option is that I would go just so I can touch his hair and see what goes into it.
Yeah, fair enough. So we'll open that one up when this podcast is online.
Exactly. But that concludes the first section of this episode of Sportspiel. But stick around, because of course we have our feature interview section to come up after the break. And since it's a very special guest, I will let the man that did the interview introduce.
Yes, so this is one interview you definitely do not want to miss. We were lucky enough to get a very short amount of time with Sammy Kinghorn. She is preparing for the World Para Athletics Championships coming up in London. She has a realistic chance of 4 gold medals. She is also very open and very candid about a horrendous accident that happened when she was 14, how it turned her life around, and how she's used that for the better. She's now potentially going to become the next poster girl for British athletics. She's an absolutely wonderful person, great to listen to, and yeah, make sure you stick around for that. Hello and welcome back to the 6th episode of Sportspiel, where I'm delighted to say we are joined today by Sammy Kinghorn, a wheelchair racer who competed for Scotland at the 2014 Commonwealth Games and Team GB at Rio 2016. Welcome to the show, Sammy.
Hello.
So we're very lucky and grateful to both Sammy and our coach Ian for setting up this interview at such short notice, as she is in the middle of a hectic training schedule ahead of the World Championship starting in London in just 3 weeks. Sammy, how is everything going ahead of the event?
Yeah, everything's going really well. I've decided to stay at home just in the lead up to London. So, yeah, I've got everything I need working out really well. And all the studio and my coach and everything nice and close by. So, yeah, everything's looking pretty good in the run-up.
Fantastic. And we'll come back to that later, but we'll go back to sort of the very beginning, basically. So a lot of people who might be listening to the show have grown up in quite metropolitan areas, quite sort of city and urban based areas, but life was slightly different for you, I guess, growing up on the Scottish borders as a young child.
Yeah, I grew up in a really rural place in the Scottish Borders. Kind of the closest well, small village was 3 miles away, and then the closest shop was half an hour away. So I lived in a place with about 5 houses and a lot of fields and sheep. But I had a great childhood, and I always really enjoyed it because I loved being outside and playing and being on the farm.
And you say you're growing up on a farm. How was that for you? Were you quite hands-on when you were younger?
Yeah, I loved it, especially with sheep and things. I really enjoyed lambing when I was really young, and I still do now. And I used to take time off school all the time just to help my dad out so that, you know, I could be out playing on the farm.
And were the school okay with that?
Most of the time they didn't know, but I enjoyed that far more than being at school.
And was that was quite a family orientated thing then? You sort of all helped out together?
Yeah, I think my dad worked a lot of hours, so for me to bond with my dad was going out on the farm. My mum isn't interested in the farm at all, so you know, my dad is out there constantly.
And you say you enjoy going back there now. Is it just sort of quite nice then to get a break away from it all and just sort of return back to a normal lifestyle?
Yeah, it's really nice. I think my dad's always on about it. Fresh air. The fresh air helps everything. I love going back and just going out around the farm on my quad and just kind of being a child again and playing like I used to when I was younger.
And aside from the farming, were you quite sporty as a child? Did you do any particular activities at all?
I did quite a fair bit of sport. I played hockey, I done ballet, I done gymnastics. It was all just at social level because my friends done it, and so I just carried on along with it. But I loved sport, and I always enjoyed running and playing around. I was always outside doing things.
So you were still quite a sporty child then?
Yeah, definitely. I don't think I ever thought sport was going to be, you know, my career in the future, but I did always really enjoy. I've done a lot of activities after school and things like that.
And then we have the life-changing moment that happened for you when you were 14. Could you perhaps talk us through that a little bit, if that's okay?
Yeah. So when I was 14, I was born able-bodied, and when I was 14, I was in an accident where my father was driving a forklift, and I jumped onto part of the forklift thinking that he'd seen me. He was clearing snow. It had been snowing really, really heavy over the week, and I had had my accident in 2010, and I thought he'd seen me climb onto the forklift, and he hadn't seen me, and he crushed me underneath the boom. So that kind of changed my life forever, really. I spent 6 months in the spinal unit, and I was told straight away that I wasn't going to walk again, and I knew as soon as it happened that was it, really. 6 months at 14 years old, away from your mum and dad, sent to Glasgow, which is about 2 hours away from my house, to kind of learn how to be myself again, how to be independent again.
And I guess you said you knew straight away that it wasn't great. What was going through your head at the time?
The first feeling I felt was guilt, probably, because I thought that I was going to die and my dad was going to feel like he was the one that had killed me. So straight away I felt really guilty. And then, obviously, the sheer amount of pain. I can still remember, you know, my heart thumping out of my chest as I watched as you know, I felt my back go. I felt it break, and I knew this isn't good. I watched as my dad shoveled up some snow and lifted the bucket back up, and I thought, I need to get out now, I need to run away. And I ran for a bit, and then I slipped and I fell. And I lay on the ground, I felt my legs pretty much, they were spasming really bad, and all my muscles were twitching, and then everything just kind of tightened up and let go, and that, I knew that was the last time that I was going to feel my legs again. I was more telling my mum and dad, I was telling my mum I need to phone the hospital because I've broke my back and I'm not going to walk again, and I don't think anyone really believed me.
And that sounds, for any of us listening, that the thought of actually having that happen to us is horrible. And I guess sort of when you sort of first got into hospital and that, how did you cope? How did you deal with it?
First of all, I knew I wasn't going to walk again, but I thought that I was going to be stuck in bed forever. I'd never met anyone with a physical disability before in my life, so I'd never seen anyone in a wheelchair. So I just thought that that'd be stuck in bed forever, and that was going to be me. And the way I cope with it was just plan my life. So I could do an online uni course. I'll invent something to help people in the same situation as I was. I think I knew that my mom and dad were very nervous, very upset, and I knew that if I started crying, then my mom and dad might not ever stop. So I knew that I had to be the one that was going to have a stiff upper lip and get on with.
That's an incredible resolve, but there must have been some tough times though, especially earlier on.
I think it was always really silly things that I used to get. It was more frustration than actually upset, like frustration for not being able to do things as fast as I used to, just getting into a car or things like that. That's what I got more frustrated about than actually lying in bed and feeling sorry for myself. I didn't really get that because I was just pleased that I was alive. You know, I think the thing I got most frustrated about was not being able to wear heels one night, and I got really upset over it all. And obviously, I had bottled things up and got really upset because I couldn't put a pair of heels on my feet. And I remember my friend just like laughing at me and saying, "You didn't cry after you broke your back. Why are you crying? You can't put these heels on your feet." And it's funny now looking back, but in the moment, you know, I was 14 years old. That's all I cared about. It was a relic.
And you said it was 6 months. Was that a sort of recovery? And that was that all in one hospital, or did you have to move about a bit?
That was all in one hospital in the Queen Elizabeth Spinal Unit in Glasgow. So you go into like a certain ward first where they look after you and you get your operation and all that kind of stuff, and then Phillips Hill, which is rehab, and you go to rehab from 9 till 12, and then get an hour for lunch, and then from 1 till 4. And it's tough, you know, it is literally, when you go through the rehab in the spinal unit, it's like going into a nursery. You know, there's people wobbling around trying to learn to sit up again, and people trying to learn to write again, and people trying to learn to feed themselves. And some people who are lucky enough to learn to walk again. It is like being born again is the best way to describe a spinal injury.
And you mentioned earlier you were quite sporty when you were growing up. Did you think that sort of once you'd gone over this, got through the rehab, that you could then get into a disability sport, say like wheelchair racing, or was that not at the front of your mind?
Not at all. I didn't like I said, I didn't know anything about disabilities. I didn't know anything about disability sport. I think when we used to do sports through the day and things in the hospital, but I didn't realise that it was a career path or anything like that until I went to the spinal unit games and then. Kind of got told there that, you know, I could be really good at this, and
Did you try out a number of different sports, or was it straight into a wheelchair and you just sort of realised that you were quite good at it?
I tried it loads. It's funny, the games, so you get selected from your hospital, and then a certain amount of patients go down to Stoke Mandibles from Scotland, England, Wales, Ireland, all the spinal units, and you compete. So the way you win is you try as many sports as you can. You get a little ticky sheet and they get ticked off as you try out all the sports. So I did try out everything and I really enjoyed everything. And I think the reason that I chose wheelchair racing was because it was fast and because I thought it looked pretty cool. It was a smart bit of kit. It didn't really look like a major disability. And the girl that was going around, she was going faster than the guy was running with her. So I quite liked the thought of being faster than I was before.
Fair enough. And then at what point, was it at that point you realised this could be maybe a career path for you, or are you still thinking this is just something to help me through?
Yeah, I was still just kind of thinking this looks quite fun. I could go out and do this with my friends. And then I got back and got introduced to my coach and kind of started from there. Obviously, I had to fundraise and things for my first racing chair because they're not cheap. So I got my first racing chair in 2012. And even then, I don't think I was really that aware of the Paralympics or of it as a pathway or anything like that. I just knew that I quite enjoyed being in my race chair and I enjoyed pushing around.
And if I'm right in thinking, your sort of first major competitive race was the London 2012 Mini Marathon?
Yeah, that was my first race.
And how did that go for you?
That was really good. It was my first time to London. It was my dad's first time to London as well. So my mom and dad came down. And even then, I remember getting on the start line and being really surprised by the kids that were there, because they all looked really elite. You know, they had muscle. They were all, you know, we're all 16 and under, so you know, we're not ridiculously old or anything. And I was really surprised by how many kids were there as well, because there's not obviously many of us in Scotland. And yeah, I really loved it. It was incredible. Obviously, you have all the crowds that are there for the marathon. And it was, yeah, it was really amazing. I came second in my first race in London, mini marathon.
And then at that point, were you starting to then think, okay, I'm quite good at this, it could lead to other things?
Yeah, I think after that, I was kind of looking forward to getting classified so that I could compete wider. And then, yeah, after I was classified, and I quickly realised that I was number one in Britain and starting to get noticed, then that's when I kind of thought, yeah, maybe I could do something with this.
And that must have been quite a cool feeling as well, that people were starting to notice you and you were one of the top athletes.
Yeah, it was weird because I hadn't been in it for very long and I hadn't even been in a chair for very long. I was still very new to the whole disability scene. So it was a really fast climb up ladder for me, which was pretty surprising.
And then we'll skip forward a little bit to Glasgow 2014. You're competing for Scotland at your home games. When you got the call, when you heard you were selected, how did that feel for you?
That was amazing. You know, that was a real turning point for me because I would have never competed for my country if I was able to bid, and that was a moment where I was like, wow, I'm actually doing incredible things that I would have never had the opportunity to do in my other life. So it was incredible for me. And Glasgow's where it all began. You know, it's where I learned to be myself again. So it was amazing to be there, and obviously it being a home game, it's meant my granny and all my family could come up, and I don't think I'll ever be able to actually put it into words what Glasgow really felt like, because it still makes me smile when I thought of going into the stadium and hearing the roar was just absolutely incredible.
And the racing itself, how did it go from your perspective?
Yeah, I think it went really well. Obviously, it's my first major. I'd only really been in the sport for a year and a half. I'm still very new to it all, and I had to compete upper class within disability sport. It was a C54 1500 metres, and I'm a C53, so it means that when I'm in my racing chair, I don't have any core stability, so when I'm pushing, it's just my arms that are powering me, and there's a class above me, which is called a T54, and they have full trunk control, so when they're pushing in their chair, they're able to lift their chest up, their knees, and put that little bit of extra power in through their wheels. So I was competing in it's an open race, T53-54 race for the 1500 metres. And even the 1500 metres was pretty new to me. I far more enjoy sprinting. I like to see where the finish line is and know that I'm done after I cross that line. I don't have to do another three laps. So, it was not my favourite event at the time, it still isn't, but I really, really enjoyed it. And you're not going to say no to the chance of wearing a Scotland vest.
Yeah. And another thing that we saw at the Commonwealth Games that year was the record number of para sports taking place in the same event alongside non-disabled sports. That's quite a positive thing, isn't it, to have those two competing alongside each other rather than separately?
Yeah, I think when they can, logistically, it should be. Obviously, Paralympics and Olympics, logistically, it can't ever be put together because of the amount of athletes we end up. Which isn't fair, because we have more than just one men and one woman 100 metres, you know, there's all the different classifications, so, you know, it just wouldn't work putting us together, but things for, you know, Commonwealth Games is great, it can be integrated, and it should be, and, you know, things like Worlds and things could probably possibly be integrated, so hopefully one day it would be great to have it fully integrated.
And then speaking of Worlds there, we'll sort of combine the 2014 Europeans and the 2015 Worlds. It saw you get your first competitive medals with three golds in the Europeans and then a bronze at the Worlds. How did it feel to win medals on such a competitive stage?
That was really nice. Obviously, my Europeans was about 2 weeks after Glasgow, so I'd had that feeling of competing for my nation, and I got my Scotland best, and then I got my GB kit, which was... It was an incredible feeling. It was a really surreal feeling to have, both bests in 1 year and to come home with medals as well. You know, to see my mum and dad in the crowd and all my family and friends all crying and you know, just really happy with, you know, everyone that's been there through my whole journey and knowing where I've come from to get there. It was really, really special. And then obviously going on to Worlds and being on the world stage.
And the Worlds themselves, they took place in Doha. How did you cope with the heat out there?
Yeah, that was really hot. It was more the humidity than anything. We saw struggled to love, but the wheels, with the humidity, the wheels would get really wet and slippy. And so things like that. And we had a couple of sandstorms. It was just all, yeah, a bit murky. But it was pretty good. I like the heat, so it was quite nice to race in.
And then speaking of heat, of course, last year, Rio, you went to the Paralympic Games representing GB, arguably the biggest stage for you. How was that for you?
Yeah, it's a dream come true, really, to compete at the highest level in your sport, and that is the highest level I'll ever be able to compete at. So that was incredible. To get that phone call and to be selected and to go to Paralympics after quite a short career still, it was amazing. And I think Rio done a really good job, though, because there was so many worries going into it and people telling scare stories. But to my knowledge, it ran really well, and I thought it was a really good event.
One thing I know people were worried about, especially with the Paralympics, was the crowds. But certainly in the athletic stadium, the crowd seemed to be very vocal and quite numerous as well. Is that how you found it?
Yeah, you know, we were lucky, I think, that we had fuller stadiums than the Olympic guys, so that was pretty cool. I think they got in quite a few of the kids, and they just lowered the prices a wee bit for you know, people can't really afford it in the third world country, so, you know, they're not going to be able to afford very expensive tickets to go and see people, so they lowered them a wee bit, and that was amazing. At one point, my dad had a whole band chanting my name, so that was pretty cool.
Was it a different atmosphere of crowd as well in Brazil compared to somewhere, say, like in Europe?
I think people were, like, there was that party feel. Mm-hmm.
And you yourself, you had, from what seemed from the outside, a very good Rio. You made three finals, you finished fifth and sixth, you set personal bests. Did you ever expect to do so well?
No, I went to Rio and I just wanted to make finals. That's all I wanted to do. And to go and do that, I was absolutely over the moon. It was very scary, and I had a few sleepless nights. So, I know that I've still got so much to learn from, and that's the best thing to come away from something, is knowing that it wasn't perfect and I've got a lot to learn.
And you're only 21 years old at the moment, but this year alone you've set PBs across the board in pretty much all your track events. People are already now starting to talk of you as the next big thing in sort of British sport, and how does that feel for you?
Yeah, that's especially this year, being at the front is different for me. Instead of, you know, people chasing me instead of me chasing everyone else, has been really strange for me. It's a nice change, though. But I love what I do, and I couldn't do it, obviously, if I didn't love it. But, you know, I want to be the best. I don't do it so that I'm okay and I'm up there. I want to be the best wheelchair racer in the world, so. I know it's going to take me a long time to get there, but I'm going in the right direction.
And being compared to the likes of other British poster girls such as Kadina Cox, Hannah Cockcroft, Jess Ennis, Kate Richardson Walsh from Another Sport, is that something you ever thought would happen to you?
Oh, no, never in my wildest dreams I would have thought that I'd ever be compared to anyone like that, especially in a sporting sense. I still find it very surreal, because I still don't see myself there yet. Mm-hmm. I see, you know, I speak to Hannah Cockcroft and I think, wow, look at all the amazing things she's achieved. And the day that if I ever, you know, win my gold medal, it'll be incredible and it'll be a real honour to be anywhere near to them.
And you say if you win a gold medal, it's looking quite likely that you will with the Worlds, or is that something you're still sort of saying, I just want to get a medal and then a gold, or are you going in thinking I can get a gold?
I think you need to go in thinking that you can do anything. There's no point setting your bar low, because then you're only ever going to reach that. I always make sure that I set my aim pretty high, because, you know, I want to, you know, obviously everyone wants to win a gold medal one day. But I think for now, I just think I want to get to the finals, and then, you know, on the day of the finals, you just kind of got to see who's best in the day, and I'll shake hands to whoever, you know, crosses the line first. But, you know, I'd like to be up there.
And the 200 metres especially, you set a new world record in the T53 event last year. again, do you sort of see yourself as favourite, or again, are you just sort of going in wanting to win, and then if you don't win, you'll still shake hands with whoever wins?
Yeah, of course. You know, it's going to be a funny feeling getting introduced to the crowd as a world record holder for that event. I think, obviously, I am going to be the one to watch for that event. But again, you don't know what's going to happen on that night. It's kind of got to hope that it's my night and not anyone else's.
And it's a chance for you as well to compete in the Olympic Stadium in Stratford, the home of so many great memories for GB in 2012. How are you feeling ahead of that?
Yeah, I'm really excited for that. I watched 2012, obviously I just started the sport then, and it really inspired me. I remember watching David Weir and Hannah and things like that, and getting goosebumps and thinking one day, Mum, Dad, I'm going to be on that track, and I'm really glad I'm getting the opportunity to do that. So obviously it's not going to be an athletics track forever, so I'm glad I'm getting the opportunity to compete on that. You know, it's a famous track, isn't it?
Yeah. And who do you think, across any of the races you'll be competing in, who do you think your toughest opponent is going to be in London?
There's two Chinese athletes that'll be probably the toughest opponents, because we don't know where they are or what they're at. They kind of hide themselves, so you know they're going to come out in form, and you know they're going to be pushing very fast, and you don't know until you get there. All the other girls are raced, and I kind of know where they're at, and I know the Americans will be fast, and I know that the Australians are going to be fast, but with the Chinese, you just don't know what form they're going to be in.
Of course, and we're going to go. I'll go away for our last couple of questions away, and sort of, you've mentioned your mum and your dad quite a lot, but who would you say have been the biggest influences on your career?
I think obviously my physio, probably, because she started it all, and she took me to my first athletics track and my first event, and she was really great. And probably my brother. I remember before the Europeans, I was really nervous. I really, really wanted, now I was favourite going into it, I really wanted to win that gold medal. And I remember phoning him, and he pretty much just told me, he just told me, I don't care if you win or lose a medal. I just want to see you having fun.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think I always go to events now just thinking, it doesn't matter where I come as long as I enjoy it. So yeah, my brother is probably the reason I'm so competitive as well. Mm-hmm. So I've got to thank him for something.
And a final question from me. Away from the racing and away from helping out on the farm, you do quite a lot of motivational speaking as well. And I'm just wondering, how important is it for you to sort of get your message across to kids especially, and how they respond to your story?
I find it really important, I think, because I had no knowledge of disability growing up. It was a very scary place for me to be in when I was told that I was never going to walk again.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like it's something that should be introduced to schools and kids should know about it. I probably would have thought that a physical disability would be, you know, they're not okay in their head, or, you know, there's more things going on. And I wouldn't know how to approach someone in my situation. And a lot of kids are like that. They don't know how to approach them because they've never been, you know, it's not really pushed out in their faces. They get told by their parents to hush and don't stare and don't look. And I think they should. They should be allowed to ask any questions so that they understand, because you get to a certain age and then you're too scared to ask, and you just start to assume things. And then when they assume that, when bullying starts and things like that. So I think kids should be taught at a young age that it's just my legs that don't work. I just can't stand up and put one leg in front of the other. But apart from that, I'm just the same as you. And kids take it really well. And then, you know, once they've accepted it, they just want to go in my wheelchair, and they don't really care after that, which I think is really great.
And what's sort of one of the nicest or one of the most memorable things that one of the children have said to you after one of those talks?
I think there was one boy one day, and I could see him looking at me, and he was really confused, and he would have been about maybe 7 or 8, and he just had that really confused look on his face, and I was like, what's wrong? And he was just like, so you can't stand up? And I was like, no. And he was like, but you can read and write. And I was like, yeah. And then like, right, so you're just like me, but you push instead of walk. And I was like, yeah, that's it. And he was just like, all right, okay. And that was him. He completely accepted it.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't care. He really didn't care that I couldn't put up on one leg in front of the other. He just kind of accepted that I was exactly the same as him. I enjoyed watching sport. I enjoyed doing sport. I enjoyed having a laugh. I enjoyed all the things that he enjoyed.
Mm-hmm.
I just didn't run.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's just your whole story, frankly, is amazing. And the resilience you've shown astounds me. And I just wanted to say a massive thank you for joining us today, Sammy.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks again to Sammy for taking part in that interview, and we'd just like to take this moment to quickly remind you about our Donald Trump poll. If you had won the NBA championship and you were invited to the White House, would you go yes, no, or would you go just to touch the man's hair?
Sometimes worry what sort of thought processes you go through.
It's all a learning process, so it's all about. But of course, you can follow us on social media at SportsspielPod. We're on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And you can email us feedback. Our email address is sportsspielpod@gmail.com. That's all from this episode of the Sportsspiel. We'll be back in 3 weeks' time because Will is going on holiday. I'm not jealous at all. Tune back in 3 weeks' time and have a good time. Until then,